Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Gaitis, Judge Larson. The Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is April 12, 2023. This panel of the court today has three cases on its agenda for oral argument. The first case is number A22-836, State of Minnesota versus Mark Allen Lasek. Counselor, familiar with our procedures? So, counsel for appellant, you may approach and the lectern, and please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant appellate public defender, and I represent Mark Lasek, the appellant in this matter. Lasek raised three issues for this court's consideration, but my argument today is going to focus on the first. Before a district court can accept a guilty plea from a defendant who claims to be innocent, there must be a strong factual basis establishing every element of the offense. Here, Lasek's plea to attempted first-degree murder was deficient on exactly the element that he contested throughout, the intent to cause the death of KAC. Because his plea was constitutionally inaccurate, we ask this court to reverse and remand for plea withdrawal. The intent to kill has been the issue from almost from day one in this case, when it formed the basis of Lasek's motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause. It was the basis of his departure argument at sentencing. But perhaps most importantly, it's the difference between first-degree arson, which carries a presumptive sentence of 48 months, and attempted first-degree murder, which carries a presumptive sentence of 180 months. And yet, when it came time for the Elford plea, the state presented very little evidence on this element, and almost no evidence, really no evidence distinguishing it from first-degree arson. The evidence in this case that the state presented at the plea record was that KAC had recently ended her relationship with Lasek. Lasek was angry about that. He had sent her texts expressing anger about that fact and threatening to burn her house down. He specifically came to her house, in fact, set the house on fire and used an accelerant. Arguably, that is enough to establish first-degree arson, which is exactly what Lasek argued from the very beginning, that that's what the state's evidence supports. But there is not enough evidence here to show that he attempted to cause her death.
Well, he's admitting that the state's evidence is sufficient to—he admitted the state's evidence is sufficient, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
To talk about sufficiency of the evidence is not really the issue. The issue is whether there's a factual basis for the plea.
That's right, Your Honor, because TICE does have two requirements. One is that the defendant acknowledge the sufficiency of the state's evidence to convict him at trial, and the second requirement is for a strong factual basis to be developed at the plea record.
And I think a third requirement, the district judge has to independently conclude there's a strong probability that the defendant would be found guilty.
That's right, Your Honor.
And that was done, and you're not challenging that.
No. That was an erroneous conclusion because this court has access to the exact evidence that the district court had in this case, and it's clearly inadequate. The state did not describe enough evidence to support a verdict.
You're right. I was about to form a question. Does your argument hinge on the particular person whom he intended to kill?
Not necessarily, but it is critical here. The state has conceded, and I think it is clear that to be convicted of attempted first-degree murder of KAC. There has to be evidence of an intent to kill KAC.
So then why must the state establish that he intended to kill KAC rather than SJG?
She's the named victim in this offense.
Where is she named?
In the factual basis, the state has conceded throughout that this is a plea to kill KAC. I'd have to look back through the plea record to see exactly where in the factual basis it says specifically her, but that has been, I don't think that's been contested throughout the case.
I'm a little confused about that argument, quite honestly, because I don't think that the identity of a particular individual is an element of the offense. Would you agree with that proposition?
I'd have to think about that, Your Honor. You might be right, but even so, there's not enough evidence to show. Again, the state has conceded that it needed to prove that he had an intent to kill KAC. But also, even if it's true that that an intent to kill SJG would be sufficient to sustain this factual basis, that's not sufficient either, because here all we have is, he knew that he was in the home. But without some additional facts to show an actual intent to kill him, there just isn't enough here.
Can't we infer the intent given what he clearly knew and given his actions?
There may be an inference available based on these facts, but it's a weak inference. And we've argued today, and I think it's correct, that to evaluate the strength of the state's evidence here, we have to use a circumstantial evidence standard. Because had the state gone to trial with this evidence and Lasik appealed, this court would use that standard to determine whether there was, in fact, sufficient evidence to support his conviction.
You say if he had gone to trial, but he didn't go to trial. I mean, it was a guilty plea, so...
No, but he did maintain his innocence. And so it was the state's job to show that it had enough evidence to support a conviction. And in fact...
Well, okay, you say to show. That sounds like to prove. They didn't have to prove. He was admitting that the state had... He didn't admit all of the underlying facts, but he had acknowledged the state's evidence is sufficient, and he said he wanted to plead guilty. But it seems to me, you cited the Nelson case, I think, in your brief, which is a recent Supreme Court case, saying that, you know, I think the gist of it is that even if the factual record of a guilty plea does not contain all of the facts that we might expect to see in a trial record, you know, and if we were doing a sufficiency review, if the intent or other facts can be inferred from the factual record, then that's sufficient in a guilty plea.
I agree that's what Nelson says, Your Honor. But Nelson did deal with a typical guilty plea, and it was supported by Nelson's admission of guilt. Here we have an Elford plea, which this court's case law and the Supreme Court case law is clear that we need to use extra scrutiny because there is an inherent conflict between it maintaining innocence and pleading guilty.
But is there any case law sort of similar to the case law that we find in the sufficiency of the evidence context suggesting that circumstantial evidence in an Elford plea is viewed any differently than direct evidence?
There certainly is not published case law, but the inquiry here is whether there's a strong probability that he would be convicted at trial. And to be convicted at trial, there has to be adequate evidence.
But do you disagree that it's a different burden, that a strong factual basis is a different burden than proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Because I think that, you know, what I struggle with is the circumstantial evidence test is saying, is there enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt? That's sort of the underlying analysis that we're doing. And do you disagree that those are different burdens?
You know, I don't disagree that they're different burdens, but honestly, it's not obvious to me that the burden on an Elford plea and the burden for sufficiency of the evidence, that it's lower. I think that sufficiency of the evidence is a floor. Because here, the accuracy of the plea, the point of the accuracy requirement is to ensure that the defendant isn't pleading guilty to a more serious offense than he can be convicted of at trial. And so if the state doesn't have enough evidence to convict him at trial, that's a problem. And here, the way we know whether there is, you know, at minimum enough evidence to sustain a jury verdict is that this court would apply the circumstantial evidence standard. And I think, you know, anyone who works in criminal law has seen cases where the evidence is theoretically and technically sufficient to convict. They're not going to prevail on appeal, but we think, you know, can't believe the jury actually convicted on this. And because there's that tension there, I don't think it's necessarily true that a strong probability that the jury would convict is a lower standard than ensuring that the state has sufficient evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the whole point of the accuracy requirement, is to ensure that the state in fact has that. And that's the judge's job, to look at it, carefully scrutinize it, and Goulet says that's a critical piece of the Alford analysis because of this inherent conflict that calls the rationality of the decision into question.
Assuming that we agree with you that the circumstantial evidence standard applies, what would the reasonable alternative hypothesis be given the evidence that Mr. Lasek knew somebody was present and started a fire using accelerants?
The alternative reasonable hypothesis is that he didn't intend to kill anyone, and that in fact he intended to commit first degree arson, which under the first degree arson statute, if there is a person in the building, that's first degree arson. And it's that intent to kill piece that makes it a much more serious offense. Here, if we had slightly different facts, I think that it would eliminate all reasonable inferences consistent with innocence. So, you know, if it looked more like some of the attempted first degree murder by arson cases that have been cited by Lasek throughout. So, had he barricaded the doors? Had he, you know, in this case, he made a huge noise and then set a small part of the house on fire. He didn't assault anyone inside. He didn't break in, and he didn't throw a Molotov cocktail in. There are other facts that I think would eliminate all reasonable inferences consistent with innocence, and I think that's why it's not an unreasonable standard of review here, because I think it's very, the state could meet it. It just didn't here. So I think in this case, he, in particular, because this has been the contested element, he has said throughout that the state did not have enough evidence to prove intent to kill. And, you know, it's not specifically in the record, but it sure looks like he would have pleaded guilty to first-degree arson. And so if that's all the state needed to prove, we probably didn't have to do this Alford plea. In the end...
Ms. Schultz, if we were to accept your argument that the circumstantial evidence standard of appellate review should be inserted into the Alford Goulet Tice analysis, wouldn't that then require the district court to conduct that analysis at the time of making the independent determination that there's a substantial likelihood? In other words, would we be imposing on district judges an obligation to conduct that type of analysis, you know, before accepting the plea?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Certainly, if the district court wanted to make sure that the factual basis is going to stand up on appeal, it would probably make sense to keep that in mind. But I know this court's decision in State v. Olson, I think just a few months ago, said that, you know, generally that is a standard review that's applied by the reviewing court, and there are only very limited circumstances where the district court has to do that. So I don't think our position imposes a requirement that the district court go through that analysis. But I think it would make sense to keep in mind if you're thinking about is there enough evidence to show a strong probability that the jury would convict? And I think implicit in that is would that conviction hold up on appeal? Is it actually supported by sufficient evidence?
But Tice doesn't. Tice mentions the jury, but Tice doesn't mention the appellate court, right?
No, that's true, Your Honor. And I think there is not absolutely clear guidance on what strong probability that the jury would convict means, what a strong factual basis means, and that's why we're proposing here that applying the circumstantial evidence standard when the Alford plea is based on circumstantial evidence is the most logical way to assess and ensure that there's actually adequate evidence to support a jury verdict, to make sure that he couldn't be convicted of a, that he isn't pleading guilty to a more serious offense than he could have been convicted of had he gone to trial. I see that my time is almost up, but if this court has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
It appears there are none, at least not at this time.
Thank you. We ask that this court reverse Mr. Lasek's conviction and remand for plea withdrawal. Okay.
And you will have an opportunity for rebuttal, as you know. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. I'm Kelsey Kelly. I'm an assistant Anoka County attorney, and I represent the state in this matter. Mr. Lasek has not suffered a manifest injustice. His plea was valid, and the state asks the court to affirm his conviction. As the court has already pointed out, that for an Alford plea to be valid, there must be a strong factual basis, and the defendant must acknowledge that the evidence would be sufficient for a jury to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And the record shows that both of those prongs have been met. In my brief, I quoted the very long offer of proof given by the prosecutor in the case, and he laid out the most significant evidence about the intent is that the Lasek actually texted KAC saying, "I'm going to burn your house down," in addition to several other very angry text messages.
But that, Ms. Kelly, I mean, taking that at face value, that sounds like he wanted to destroy some of her property.
Your Honor, the fact that he went to a dwelling where he knew there was somebody home, he did not know that KAC was not home. He used an accelerant to make the fire spread faster in a dwelling, shows his intent to kill. This is not just simply somebody breaking a window and running away. The evidence and the offer of proof shows that he broke a window by throwing something in with an accelerant to make the fire spread faster, which would cause somebody in the dwelling to die either by smoke inhalation or the fire itself. So this is a lot different than damage to property.
How is it different from first-degree arson, though?
It's different from first-degree arson because he explicitly said, "I'm going to go and burn your house down," while he was extremely angry at KAC. In addition, he knew that somebody was in the house. And first-degree arson, if I'm not mistaken, does not require for it to actually, for someone to be home, it requires for it to be a dwelling. And although it is the state's case that he did this with the intent to harm KAC, the offer of proof also supports the fact that he also intended to kill SG, because SG was actually home. The fact that he knew that somebody was home and he used an accelerant to start a fire makes it very different than a typical first-degree arson case.
Aren't accelerants used often in arsons?
Yes. I think they are very often used in arsons. This case is different because someone was home. The defendant went to the house looking for KAC. The SG, the roommate, told him essentially, "Get out of here, go away, we don't want you here." So the defendant didn't actually know that KC was not home, and he knew that SG was.
Wait a minute. Do we know that? Do we know what the defendant knew about whether or not she was home?
We don't. Circumstantially, I think it can be inferred that that's what we know because of the text message to KAC, "I'm going to burn your house down." He goes there looking for her, knows there's a person there, throws something through the window because we know the window breaks and the fire starts.
Can you go back? What did you say about his knowledge about whether she's home?
So he goes to her house after texting that I'm going to burn your house down to her, looking for her, and he's sent away. He's not informed that she's not home.
Do we know what he was informed? I mean, I know that, I think the proffer is that he demanded to be let in but was turned away.
Yes.
I don't know if we have any information about whether SG said anything to him about whether KC was there.
Your Honor, I would agree that the offer of proof does not explain exactly what conversation took place. I was inferring, since he was turned away, that he was told, just, like, get out of here, not that he was explicitly told that KC wasn't home. But that's still, he still knew that that SG was home. Someone was in that house, and it was a dwelling. He used an accelerant. There is no other way to look at these facts other than the fact that he intended to kill someone who was in there. He didn't call 911. He ran away. When he was arrested, they found gasoline on his clothes, and his car matched the video of the person fleeing the scene, so we knew it was him. And the fact that the defendant actually conceded, as part of the Alford plea, he stated that the evidence was sufficient for the jury to find him guilty, and he acknowledged that there was a strong factual basis, and the court also backed up the fact that the defendant conceded that. And that's why the circumstantial evidence standard should not apply here. This is different than a jury verdict, because the defendant himself is saying, I concede that, or I waive that. He's saying that there is a substantial likelihood, based on this evidence, that I will be convicted, where if you have a bench or a jury trial, the defendant never concedes that. And the state has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The state doesn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in its offer of proof, based on the circumstantial evidence test, when a defendant is conceding. The point of the guilty plea is the concession and the waiver of the rights.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that, and I'm paraphrasing, and appellant can correct me if this isn't a fair paraphrase of the argument, but that the circumstantial evidence test presents a floor of what the state's burden is to prove on a case, and that is the reason why we should apply the circumstantial evidence test when evaluating whether there's a strong factual basis?
So in terms of evaluating a jury or a bench trial, I do think that that is the floor. However, when a prosecutor, a judge, and a defense attorney is sitting in a courtroom trying to figure out how to do a guilty plea, we're often meeting elements. We're not sitting there for 20 minutes explaining the entire case of the state. We are sitting there meeting elements, getting the waiver, and the defendant is conceding. Although an Alford plea is different because they're maintaining their innocence, but they're conceding a substantial likelihood that they will be convicted based on this evidence. Whereas in a typical guilty plea, the defendant is the one who is giving us the information versus the prosecutor putting the offer of proof on the record. So the fact that the prosecution put this offer of proof on the record, meeting the elements, and the defendant then assures, yes, I agree, there is a substantial likelihood that I will be convicted on this evidence. That's why the circumstantial evidence standard should not apply, because the state isn't doing in its offer of proof every single tiny piece of evidence that it would be giving like it would at a trial. It's a lot different. We're just trying to get the elements met and to have the defendant say, there's a substantial likelihood based on this evidence I will be convicted.
Regardless of the standard that the appellate court might apply in reviewing the factual basis for this plea, do you agree that the evidence of intent to kill was purely circumstantial?
Yes, I do. I think it is purely circumstantial. You have to put all of these pieces together. You know, the text message mixed with the fact that he was very angry at KAC, the fact that he went to her home very late at night. He went there. There was someone home who answered the door, and he came prepared with an accelerant to set the house on fire, which he succeeded in, knowing someone was home. And then he ran away. He did not alert 911. He didn't call the fire department. He didn't try to alert the people inside to get out, or at least we know there's a person inside to get out. And when you put all those things together, there is an inference of guilt that does meet the elements here. So it is a circumstantial case on intent.
Different question. What was the benefit that Mr. Lasek received from this plea?
Well, the biggest benefit was that the other counts were dismissed. And I don't know exactly off the top of my head what the guideline sentence is for attempted first-degree felony murder, but I think the biggest benefit is the fact that the other charges were all dismissed so that he was able to go forward, and the state said that he could ask the court for a durational and dispositional departure and that the judge can make that decision, and that the sentence was a cap. So the state also agreed that 180 months was a cap. So it wasn't saying you will get 180. It's saying we will not ask for more than 180, which is also a benefit to him.
I'm unclear on your position about whether the intent to kill must be specific to a particular person, whether the state was required to prove that he intended to kill KC or SG or anyone. Can you, because I'm looking at your brief on pages 14 and 15, you appear to focus on KC, but then a couple pages later, you're more general in talking about a person. Can you clarify, please?
Yes, I can. It's the state's position that in order for the conviction to be affirmed, that the evidence doesn't have to show he intended to kill a specific person. It is the state's position and theory throughout the beginning of the case that he intended to kill KAC. However, this offer of proof is also sufficient for him intending to kill SG because he was home when the fire was started. So my position is we do not have to actually show that he intended one person or the other, but that it was our theory that he intended to go after KC. That was the theory of the case. It's just that I think that this offer of proof is also sufficient to prove that he intended the death of SG because he was home.
I'm looking at the complaint in count two. The state alleges that he, with intent to effect the death of the person of another or another, does not mention any particular person. I guess in the statement of probable cause, is that, and I haven't read that carefully, does the state there identify KC as the intended victim?
I'm wondering
where the theory of the case appears, I guess, is my question.
It's been a while since I read the probable cause statement, but I believe that both KC and SG are mentioned in different ways throughout the probable cause section. I don't think that the state explicitly said that the intended target of the fire or the killing was KC in that probable cause section. I can tell you just from my office working with KC that it was our belief that she was the intended target and she believes herself to be the intended target.
Does any of that matter?
No. I
mean, isn't the element a person?
Yes. That's right. Your Honor, I'm asking the court to reject using the circumstantial evidence standard in this case and to affirm Mr. Lasek's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Ms. Schultz, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have just a couple of points to make, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions. So first I want to talk about the idea of identity as an element, and I think this court is absolutely right. It is not an element. But what I think it's important to keep in mind is that you can't cobble together evidence tending to show an intent to kill KAC with evidence tending to show an intent to kill SJG. They have to stand on their own.
Why? Like, what's the legal basis for that point that you're making?
Yeah, well, Your Honor, I think in some ways, even though the state hasn't expressly argued this, we're dealing with something like the transferred intent doctrine, where the state kind of seems to be arguing that if Lasek approached this home with a kind of general intent to kill, it doesn't really matter, you know, what what happened and who it was directed at. There is a recent, 2006, I think, a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court in State v. Hall. And in that case, it was, I have the citation here for you too, I'm sorry. That's 722 Northwest 2D 472. And in that case, the district court had instructed the jury, given a transferred intent instruction, and the Supreme Court reversed. The facts were somewhat similar. The defendant in that case had gotten in two fights earlier that day, and he had left his home with a gun intending to kill three of the people he had a fight with, and had made some statements expressing an intent to kill them. He happened upon the other person first and killed him, and the district court basically said, if there was premeditation here to kill any of them, it can transfer to the actual victim. And the Supreme Court said, that's not how transferred intent works. If it's the intended, it has to be an accidental victim. If it's the intended victim, you don't get to transfer intent from a different intended victim to a second intended victim. And I think that's more or less what's going on here, is that we have some evidence, which is that most of the evidence presented in the factual basis is that Lasek was angry at KAC. Anything we have prior to him arriving at the home is directed at KAC. And then as far as SG goes, is the fact that he was present when it happened. But again, under first-degree arson doesn't require that someone is present in the building, but it does cover situations when someone is present in the building. And even as to SG, the factual basis just shows an indifference to whether he was harmed by the fire. There's nothing showing an actual intent to kill him. And the fact that he was angry at KAC, it doesn't transfer. It doesn't help the state here, even if all they need to show is that he intended to kill KAC.
Is there evidence to show intent? I think part of the state's argument is that the fact that he fled without assisting the roommate in leaving, that is evidence of intent. Why isn't that sufficient to show an
I don't think that's sufficient, Your Honor. I think it, again, shows indifference, I think, at best. I don't think it shows that he was thinking about SG at all. Certainly, that was not the considerate thing to do, obviously. But I don't think it shows an intent to kill him. He didn't set a fire that ensured his death. In fact, he was able to escape safely, thankfully. The fact that he ran, it supports a first-degree arson to the same extent that it supports a first-degree, attempted first-degree murder. I don't think it helps the state here. And then with my time running out, I just want to clarify what the defendant is conceding and what he's giving up when he enters an Alford plea. He's giving up a lot of rights, but he's not giving up all of them. He gave up his right to confrontation, to live witnesses, to a jury of his peers. But he didn't, the case law on Alford pleas is clear that the state still needs to present a strong factual basis. He didn't concede that when he agreed to enter an Alford plea. And so the fact that he conceded that the state had enough evidence doesn't get the state out of the other requirements of Tice. I see my time is up, but we ask this court to reverse his conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.